This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, The Information Advantage. Celeste Quinn is on vacation. I'm Bill Hammack. Usually you only hear me for a few minutes on Tuesday mornings talking about engineering and life, but occasionally I take a little more time and bring you interviews that reveal even further the hidden world of technology that surrounds us. Today I look at the relationship between engineering, technology, and society from an engineer's perspective. I'll chat today with a man who works every day as an engineer, but in his spare time writes about the humanism implicit in engineering. He's a regular contributor to Technology Review magazine. He writes for them a column titled The Humane Engineer. He contributes to the New York Times Sunday Magazine and frequently to the New York Book Review. He's the author of many books. Among his most prominent are The Existential Pleasures of Engineering and more recently The Introspective Engineer. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Also, keep in mind that you can listen to WILL live via the internet at www.will.uiuc.edu. Let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, Samuel Florman.
Well, good afternoon.
Hello, Sam.
Hello, and an interesting afternoon to be an engineer in New York.
Yes, we're going to discuss that in a little bit here. I wanted to start with the title of your first book, your most well-known book. It has the 24-karat word existential in it, and I want to know, why did you choose this word?
I spent a long time looking for a title, looking for a word, and I was trying to find a way of expressing the deep down feeling, the emotional feeling, the philosophical feeling, if you will, that goes into engineering beyond what we learn in our courses. Mm-hmm. Existential was the word that I had read in some philosophy courses, and it seemed to come closest to expressing those feelings that we find difficult to express, that come before reason, before rationality, and that was the word I used, and it seemed to catch on with a number of people who also believe that there is in engineering a quality that goes far beyond, is far deeper than what we learn in our courses and do in our technical work.
Well, when we look at the word existential, the first thing that comes to my mind is how we feel about existence. They were talking about a rejection of dogma and really a reliance on passions or impulses and urges. How is that related to engineering? I would think that would be the opposite.
Well, unfortunately, that's the image that engineering has perhaps created for itself. But if you think of what human beings are, what human beings want to do, the making of things, the thinking about how to make things, is perhaps as basic a quality as we can find. It's the beginning of humanity. Mm-hmm. And so many of the things that that people do, even art contains an element of constructive work. Most of our hobbies, most of the things that we enjoy are existentially satisfying, and really they are the elements of engineering.
Well, can you give me an example here of an engineering experience that isn't anti-existential? I mean, we think of it in terms of numbers and being analytical, almost desensitizing. Can you think of an engineering experience that is anti-existential?
Any completed project, I mean, I happen to be a civil engineer. I'm involved in building. Mm-hmm. As I see the building go up, It's existentially satisfying to me. It's existentially interesting and satisfying to the people we call sidewalk superintendents. Mm-hmm. As soon as you start to build something, people gather around to watch, and there's something that that really satisfies an inner need, an inner quality. And of course, when the building is complete and when you find people depending on the use of the building, we build for a lot of moderate income elderly folks, and when you see people moving into a new building who really benefit from that, you get an existential kick out of it that is difficult to equal. And then, of course, there are the daily mechanical problems, and every time you solve a mechanical problem, a technical problem, there's an element there that is, well, it's fun, it's exciting, and it answers some basic needs. So I think on many different levels, we can use that word and argue that we are much the opposite of anti-existential.
One of the things you do in your book, Existential Pleasures, is you point out how engineers were perceived differently. For example, you spend a great deal of time talking about Homer. You discuss in detail the 130 lines or so of the Odyssey, where he describes the fabrication and construction of this fabulous shield. How did Homer and other ancients, or at least ancient poets, feel about human-made objects?
Well, the interesting thing is that in the earliest days, the making of material objects was regarded quite highly. In mm-hmm. Homer's day, particularly so, and Homer himself shows great respect and affection for hardware and buildings and weapons mm-hmm. and ships and just about everything you can think of. Ironically, along with the wealth created by the Greeks and other ancient people, you began to have academies, and along came Plato and his like, and they had the luxury, and maybe it's a logical next step, to say, well, okay, we have these objects. We can take them for granted. Now let's think of something more important. What's the meaning of the universe? What's the nature of being? And suddenly you found among the Greeks and of the upper classes and the intellectuals the beginning of a disdain for the simple engineering activities.
Sam, we have a caller, a cell phone caller on line one. Caller?
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. I enjoy hearing your news broadcast on Tuesdays, mm-hmm. and I was interested in getting the opinion of the moderator and the interviewer on what they see as the distinction between engineering and science, whether this is a absolute distinction or easily defined distinction, or if it's some sort of gradation.
Sam, I'm going to let you take that, but I want to broaden it a little bit. Could you talk about engineering, science, and what you mean by technology? Are all three of those the same, or are they different?
Well, science, I think we can start with, is the search for truth. Engineering uses science, uses common sense, uses imagination. Some people would say uses aesthetic instincts in order to create objects that are useful. The engineer is not seeking truth for its own sake. The engineer is seeking to solve a problem, to help people do things that they want to do and lead better lives.
Okay.
The technologist is very much in line with the engineer. You might say a technologist is an engineer without an engineering degree, or an engineer is a technologist carried farther in the realm of education.
Mm-hmm. When we look at engineering also, we're looking at a response to a human need. I think of the example of the pyramids. They're, I believe, oriented north-south, and the engineer didn't ask, why do you want that? It was just something that the society said they needed, and it should go north-south, and that's a distinction, I believe, what a scientist would do. In fact, I want to explore with you a little bit how engineers were perceived in, say, the 19th century and such. Weren't their achievements more celebrated at that time?
They certainly were, and I guess the achievements in those days were more astonishing to the average citizen. Mm-hmm. The life, the level of comfort for the average citizen probably hadn't changed in many hundreds of years, and the way of doing things hadn't changed for many hundreds of years. And then all of a sudden, the marvels of transportation, the marvels of communication, started appearing, and the level of astonishment is not surprising. Part of the change between the last century and the century just passed might well be. A level of boredom. People became so used to marvels, mm-hmm. that they marveled less, mm-hmm. and I think that's part of what has happened. Of course, people also became better educated and more used to the new and the more understanding of the new achievements. Also, there was the element of fear, the element of discomfort, the element of disappointment when all of these new marvels didn't create the utopia that perhaps had been promised and some people anticipated would naturally follow.
Did engineers appear in the popular media of the time, or the popular press and such? Were they part of fiction or novels?
They certainly were in the early days. For example, in the United States, when we were crossing the nation with our first railroads, many novels were written by Zane Grey and others about the heroic engineers involved in those great projects, and the first building of dams, and the first the first of any of the great, the first oil wells. The engineer was regarded as a hero, almost as the cowboy had been just before.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the time you're talking about, every schoolboy knew the name, say, Roebling of Brooklyn Bridge fame or Eiffel and his tower. Now, today, few people can name the inventor of even the integrated circuit. That's the heart of course, our computers. It's almost as if engineering is an anonymous profession. Why are there no famous engineers today?
That's a very good question. And there are some engineers now trying very hard to rectify that. Of course, not only are engineers by and large anonymous, but when they are given credit, very often they're called scientists. That mm-hmm. happened not so long ago with Jack Kilby, who is one of the inventors of the integrated circuit. Made me unhappy and several others to see a large picture of Jack Kilby in the New York Times science section, and he's called a scientist.
Mm-hmm. This was when he won the Nobel Prize, I guess 2 years ago or so.
This was even before he won the Nobel mm-hmm. Prize, which of course is a Nobel Prize for science, for physics.
Mm-hmm.
There is no Nobel Prize for engineering, which is another sore point with the profession. While these heroes were being recognized in the early days, at the same time, there was a, maybe you can call it a class distinction, in which scientists were put on a higher level in a social sense, and engineers were considered, on a lower level. Interestingly, this is true of the United States, and I think we inherited it mostly from our good friends in England and the British Empire. On the European continent, the idea of the graduate of the École Polytechnique established a different situation. If you go to France, you find the engineer is more highly regarded, more well known, and more highly placed in government and in industry than you will find in the English and American situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Jack Kilby and being named a scientist. How in general are engineering and technology and the achievements of technology portrayed in the press, or at least how do you perceive them as being portrayed most often?
Well, I'm irked here in New York by saying the New York Times with a... on Tuesday, we have, it's called the science section. Yet they will definitely, it's not that they ignore the engineering and technological achievements. They just use the word science or scientist when it's really not appropriate. For example, in the space program, the achievements get their due credit, but, the word rocket scientist has come into our vocabulary.
Sure.
Rockets are not designed by scientists, by and large. They're designed by engineers. And the space program, yes, scientists are certainly involved, but the word engineer and the contribution of engineers is not given appropriate attention.
Did you see a sense of celebration in a movie like Apollo 13? I don't know if you saw that or not.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And now, how many people watching the movie will think of engineers as opposed to scientists? I don't know. But there are many people in the engineering profession, and they don't do it just to make themselves feel grandiose. I mean, everyone wants appropriate credit, but it's important for our country, it's important for our institutions to attract good young people to engineering and to have engineering achieve its proper place in the social scheme of things. It's important for the nation. It's important for the world.
This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with Samuel Florman, the author of several books that reveal the human side of engineering. Among his most prominent books are The Existential Pleasures of Engineering and, more recently, The Introspective Engineer. We're talking today about how engineering, technology, and society fit together. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Remember also that you can listen to this interview live at our website, www.WILL.UIUC.edu. Well, we've been talking about how they're portrayed in the media. Let's go to a caller. We have another caller from Champaign. Hello?
Yes. Hi, this is a great topic, and I'm just intrigued by the term engineering because having done a brief study of modern physics, most of which started in like the 1860s, like the invention of, you know, all this really cool stuff and electricity and field forces was dependent on, I believe, a Scotsman's mercury pump to create a vacuum. I can't remember his name, which some people would call technologists and some people would call scientists. And I think it's important to remember how close scientists are to their workbench. And I always think of Rutherford, who is a kind of has some North American affiliations and, you know, kind of discovered most of modern physics, was a very tinker with it. Mm-hmm. He himself couldn't tinker with it. He had lab assistants who tinkered with it for him, but he was a very tinker with it person, and there's a very close association, I think. And so I just am interested to hear about that, because I think we all think of engineers as, you know, rather staid people, but they're the ones who, in America and other parts of the world, built bridges and railroad gratings, sure, in impossible places that are just amazing to think about. And in our own history, we have a luxury of modern science where, you know, we have research physicists who are two steps removed from, you know, actually building something. But that's not a luxury most societies have, and it's a real cool part of history. So thank you. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's interesting that we've forgotten the name of the inventor of the vacuum pump, some anonymous engineer. Sam, what we're looking at here is how physics, I think, really has a very different profile in the public eye. Maybe it's more defined exactly what one is. Do you know why that's true?
The engineers are trying to stretch themselves between the scientists at one end and the practical technicians or technologists at the other end. During World War II, during the Manhattan Project, it was found that when it came to designing an atomic bomb, it was really the physicists who had the key roles, and the engineers, it turned out, were woefully under-educated in some of the sciences, physics and chemistry in particular. And in the 50s, after World War II, the education of your typical engineer curriculum was changed to increase the quotient of science. After 10 or 20 years went by, people in industry started to complain that the engineers knew too much science and were getting too far away from the workbench. They didn't understand what went on in factories, and that our manufacturing abilities or our creativity as designers was suffering. So we've sort of been going back and fourth, engineers trying to fill this wide gap. The physicists are sort of off. I think the average citizen thinks of the physicist, and perhaps correctly, in a far distant world, dealing with forces that are very difficult to understand. And have to do with the very nature of the universe. And the physicists, I think, also are I won't call them the absent-minded scientists, but they are more purely, if you can generalize, purely intellectual, abstractly intellectual, as opposed to the engineers who have to deal with the workbench tradition.
Sam, we have another caller on line 4 from Clay City. Hello?
I have a daughter. She didn't know what she wanted to do when she went to Southern to school, but she was very good in math and very good in the sciences, and she has fallen upon a career in chemical engineering. She'll be transferring to Golden, Colorado, to Colorado School of Mines. I'm told it's a very good engineering school, but she's concerned about the fact that she may end up stuck inside a building. She likes the outdoors. Any ideas of how I can encourage her? And I mean, she's working. I mean, it's a very, very disciplined type of profession. I mean, the homework is just grueling. You just simply have to work your tail off, and she has very little spare time of her own, and she gets discouraged. And just kind of curious what he has to say on the subject of how I should deal with my daughter and how I should encourage her, and what he has to think on the subject. Thank you very much.
Sam, you've been a practicing engineer about 40 years now, I guess. Any advice?
Well, the Colorado School of Mines, first of all, is an excellent school, and I would think studying mining that the young woman has great opportunities to be in the outdoors, to spend time in the outdoors, and I think there are marvelous, marvelous opportunities for women in engineering because the number of women who've been going into engineering, it rose from practically nothing, let's say 20 years ago, up to, it hasn't reached 20% of our student body, whereas women in many of the professions are practically on a par with men. So the opportunities for women are absolutely wonderful because the schools and the corporations are very anxious to have a proper representation of women. So I think the combination of the special possibilities opening up for women and the choice of mining it sounds to me like a great future there, and I would certainly encourage your daughter to stick with it. There is a problem. We call it the boot camp mentality in many of our engineering schools. The work sometimes can just be hard, and there's a movement afoot to make it not easier, but more appetizing, so to speak, to make the work less arduous.
Sam, we have another caller.
Sure.
This time from Charleston, Illinois. Hello?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Brace yourself. I'll give you a little rough time.
It's all right.
I had a friend who worked extensively with engineers, and he defined an engineer as someone whose mind was so narrow he could look through a keyhole with both eyes at the same time. And I don't think a day goes by but what I curse out design engineers. They completely overlook the human operator, his natural tendencies, and his capacities when they lay out the system of controls. As a concrete example that I'm sure many of your readers can or listeners can empathize with, the soap dishes on showers and wash basins are so shallow that it takes a great deal of care to place a wet soap bar in them without it falling out. Every morning when I shower, and my eyes are all full of soap, I reach over to put the soap in there, and I might as well just throw it on the floor of the shower because it's going to come out anyway. There's no reason this couldn't be designed with a deep enough lip that the bar of soap would sit in there readily. Well, and my own experience is with farm equipment. The design there in terms of human operator characteristics is absolutely atrocious. I have a tractor, a big tractor, where all the controls are for the right hand and they occupy a space of about a foot by 6 inches. And these different controls have all the same knob on them. And the only way you can decide whether you're going to hit the accelerator or hit the three-point hitch, drop the implement, is to look. And in the case of an emergency, when something comes up, forget about it. You can't immediately reach over and grab the right object. There's no reason part of these controls couldn't be put for the left hand, which isn't doing anything anyway, or at the very least, make the knobs identifiable by touch.
Well, let me tackle that with Sam. Sam, I know that you don't agree necessarily with the way we currently educate engineers, and Your first book was actually one called Engineering and the Liberal Arts, subtitled A Technologist's Guide to History, Literature, Philosophy, Art, and Music. And you advocated in that a liberal education for engineers. And I wanted to know why you advocate that education, and would it eradicate some of these issues of design where we're not paying attention to human needs?
Certainly, an engineer with a broader perspective is more likely to take into account the human elements, be more alert to parts, aspects of life that that don't show up in some of your textbooks. The problem with the soap, of course, might be attributable to an architect. Architects are renowned for their broad understanding and their broad education, and yet even they sometimes slip up. The understanding of what makes a useful implement is something that is constantly being worked on, and it's something that engineers certainly can use improvement on. It's been not only my own crusade, but that of quite a few other folks to make the education of the engineer broad. We call it a liberal education, and yes, there are many reasons for that. One of them being an understanding of life beyond the textbook, and what it is that people want, what people need, and also how people operate politically. That's been a downfall of many an engineering project, a failure to understand human nature. So there's a up to a point, I would agree with the caller. There is a need here. Of course, there's another field of design, industrial design. People who are part architects, part engineers, and part artists who try to, the large corporations have people like that, working to improve the designs that engineers come up with.
Sam, I wanted to move back a little bit to this. You mentioned politics. You've said that engineers are always on tap, never on top. What do you mean by that?
Well, engineers are useful. Engineers are needed. Engineers do a lot of important work, and they're available. The expression on tap means that they're there and they're called upon, and they're important in society. They're never on top. Well, the statistics show us that in this country, at least, they are not in percentage. They do not occupy top places, and certainly not in government. You look at our Congress, perhaps 1% of the Congress year after year consists of engineers and scientists combined, and look at your university presidents, and even look at your corporate presidents, the financial people, the legal people, the people with political savvy, ability to work with people, understand people, edge out the engineers when it comes to responsible positions, and that's why that expression has come into use, and it's I think a loss for our society not to have more engineers or people with engineering education in leadership positions.
One of the things you advocate to train them for that leadership is this more liberal education. And I wanted to look a little at your background. Throughout all of your of your books, there's a type of classical training in literature that's evident. I mentioned your discussion of Homer. In one of your books, you talk about poetry and compare it to engineering. Did you have any formal training in literature?
Well, I was the fortunate recipient of what we called, after World War II, the GI Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. And having studied engineering as an undergraduate, I was able, with the government paying the tuition to, after getting out of the Navy, to go on to additional study, and much to the horror of my parents at the time, I chose to study English literature. Mm-hmm. I just looked back, and maybe if everybody took a little time after school and took a little time and looked at their education, they would do the same thing. I felt, what did I miss out on? I missed out on liberal education, and the best way to fill it in was to spend a year getting a master's in literature. That's not an experience that many engineers, have available to them, mm-hmm. and I think that had quite an effect on me and set me toward thinking and writing about things that other interests engineers found they were interested in.
Sam, I want to return to something we discussed at the top of the hour, or at least alluded to, and that is that the attack on the World Trade Center. And, of course, it was an attack on a skyscraper, which is almost a symbol of American technology, at least from the 30s. It was the latest and greatest, and it made use of a highly sophisticated jetliner. Did you have a response as an engineer to it, other than just the human response that we all have to the tragedy? But did something occur to you?
Well, one thing that I have found is that 20 or 30 years ago, I think the knee-jerk negative response about technology would have been greater. In the world of the 60s, the world of the hippie and the protest against technology, the initial reaction would have been, I believe, much stronger, that this is technology and technology is our ruination. I haven't found that. I think the response has been something terrible has happened, and it's a human event. The technology used is fairly extraordinary and conventional at this point. So I think that the anti-technological impulse is less pronounced by far than it was years ago, and certainly than it was when we were fearful of nuclear war, as people were back in the 50s and the 60s.
Sam, we've reached the end of our time. Thanks for taking the time today to chat.
Well, I've enjoyed chatting with you, and of course, the University of Illinois is known for, I think, one of our largest and most prominent engineering schools. Mm-hmm. So the future of our profession is being nurtured there, I'm sure.
All right, excellent. Thank you. I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Samuel Florman, author of The Existential Pleasures of Engineering and also The Introspective Engineer. In these books, he reveals the human aspects of technology, exploring in elegant prose the creative acts of engineers.